glass, I stopped, steeled myself, and peered inside. They were right. The locals were right. In the dim lights of the room inside, I could just about make out that there was indeed what looked like a woman who seemed to hang from a column inside the room. And she did look mummified. As my eyes adjusted properly, however, I realized what it was. I mean, what it really was. It was the carved figurehead from an old boat that the owner had kept for whatever reason. And it was unvarnished, which gave it that mummified look. And that was it. Mystery solved. Eat your heart out, Scooby-Doo. I was halfway through my sigh of relief when I heard a sound. The unmistakable tip-tap of approaching paws, that kind of nylon scratch sound they make on the patio. Attack dogs, you see, are silent. Right up until the moment they pounce, and these guys were getting ready to do just that. I've never moved so fast in my life. I covered the ground back to the fence in a time Usain Bolt would be proud of, literally launching myself at the fencing, which shook as I scrambled up with the shouts of the crew in my ears. And if I'd managed the barbed wire a little gingerly on the way across, I was much more reckless on the way back. I literally laid on it, swung my legs over my head, and tumbled backwards off the top. Don't, repeat, don't try this at home. D is also for don't be an arsehole. Or D could also be for don't think you know best, or don't be a clever fucker, or just duck. It's doing what the person on the ground tells you to do, whether that's a fixer with local knowledge or the commander of a military base. If the local person on the ground says duck, watch me duck. When I was younger, I thought I knew it all. In the years since, I've learnt that I don't. I'll tell you a story. When we were making the first Afghanistan films, we were embedded with troops in Camp Bastion, which, although it's about the size of Reading these days, wasn't too big at that point, and you could run the perimeter if you wanted. So one morning a bunch of us go for a run. Me, a couple of members of the crew, who shall remain nameless for reasons that will soon become apparent, and a few of the men from the base. There were two rules. Stick to the perimeter and maintain the pace set by the instructor. It was a decent enough pace, and I had no problem sticking to it. But a couple of the crew members decided they did have a problem with it, and perhaps because they wanted to prove they were fitter than everybody else, wanted to show off, in other words, kept running off in front of the rest of the pack. But they paid for it, twofold. Firstly, because the pace was set specifically to avoid getting a nose full of the caustic sand that is unique to Afghanistan. Sand that's so sharp, filaments of it actually cut your nostrils. And they both ended up with bleeding noses. And secondly, because it took a lot of fast talking to persuade the camp commander not to put them on the first plane home. That's the golden rule. If you're being told something, you're being told it for a bloody good reason. People who make the mistake of thinking they know better than the experts end up getting hurt, or hurting other people, or removed from the job permanently. E is for everything you always wanted to know about tear gas, part one. Tear gas. A lot of people think it makes you cry, which, in a way, I suppose it does. But it's not like peeling an onion or welling up at the end of Titanic. What tear gas actually does is affect all the moisture points on your body. That includes the moisture in your eyes and in your throat, and if you're sweating, under your arms or on your crotch. And when it's activated, it burns. Bearing all that in mind, imagine you have a terrible, sweaty hangover. Imagine also that the tear gas in question is the high-grade Israeli kind of tear gas, which burns harder and for longer than any other kind of tear gas I've come across. Got it? Right. What happened took place during the making of Ross Kemp Middle East, a two-part film during which I spent time in the Gaza Strip, then went across to the State of Israel. The idea being to unravel what is one of the longest-running, fiercest and most complex conflicts of modern times, that between Jews and Arabs in Palestine. One of the most controversial aspects of the war between the State of Israel and its Arab neighbours is the Israeli-built wall that stretches over 400 miles, separating the State of Israel from the Arabs of the West Bank. Israel calls it a security fence. But the Palestinians, along with some international agencies, have a very different view. They consider it a land grab. Nevertheless, despite the fact that in places the wall is in direct contravention of international law, there it stays. A focal point for protests against the wall is the town of Nilin. From a vantage point on a hill overlooking the wall, protesters from Nilin hurl rocks at Israeli Defense Force troops to protest about the land grab, and the IDF troops respond in kind. Well, not quite in kind, as we shall see, more with interest. Now, in the film, what you see is us arriving at the scene of this demo. What I don't mention in the film is what had happened in the hours beforehand. And what had happened was this. We'd filmed until 2 o'clock the previous morning with Israeli police in Jerusalem, where I have to say, they were doing a sterling job keeping the peace in one of the most volatile cities in the world. After filming, we returned to our hotel, which was close to the beach on Tel Aviv. A secular city where the residents practice almost a live-and-let-live policy, Tel Aviv is a far cry from events taking place just a few miles away. It also has an amazing beach. Buzzing with residents and visitors doing beachy things in the day, it stays alive at night, when it turns into a nightlife hub. To our amazement and delight, it was still jumping in the early hours of the morning when we returned from filming. Along the way, we saw an open Guinness bar, and you know what it's like. Fancy a drink? Be rude not to. In we went. Playing on the TV was a pre-recorded English football match, and there was a fairly good atmosphere in the bar. And after a welcome first drink, we decided to stay for one more, and then a couple of whiskey chases, until before you knew it, we were into a full-blown session. Put it this way, we were still there at 8 o'clock the following morning, by which time we'd made plenty of new friends. And to give you an idea of how messy things had got, one of them was offering to cut my hair, and drank God knows how many pints of Guinness and whiskey chases. But don't worry, we'd had a hard week. We'd been in Gaza the week before, and it had been really tough. See, U is for underground tunnels, and we were relaxing, safe in the knowledge that we had a day off the following day. Or so we thought. We staggered back to the hotel just in time for breakfast, where I set about lining my stomach with the full Jewish ensemble. Boiled eggs, pickled herring, cheese, everything. It all went down. And the whole time as we were wolfing down this delicious breakfast, I was thinking of my bed just a few floors above my head. How when I hit that bed I was going to sleep like a king. No, like a god. I hadn't slept properly for 2 weeks, and not at all for about 4 nights. So sitting there, still drunk and filling myself with breakfast, I fantasized about what was going to be by far the best sleep of my life. With breakfast over, I bade a fond farewell to my drinking buddies and finally staggered upstairs to bed. By now it was 9 o'clock in the morning, so I took a quick shower, toweled off, launched myself at the bed, and was asleep before I made contact with the sheets. And I slept. At last, I slept. And then was woken up. My phone was ringing. I grabbed for it and squinted at the time. 11 o'clock. 11 o'clock. Tom was calling me at 11 o'clock. I'm not particularly proud of this, but mea culpa and all that, I snatched up the phone, screamed no at him and cut him off, thinking, fucking Tom at 11 o'clock, and jammed my head back into the pillow. It rang again. I ignored it. But by then, a little bell in my head had begun to ring, a bell that if it had a name would be called conscience. And I had a terrible realization. I knew this one thing. I was going to have to get up. And sure enough, the next thing I knew, somebody was banging on the door. It was Tom screaming, Ross, come on, mate, we've got to go, it's all kicking off. We're never going to get this chance again. It was Friday morning, wasn't it? It was all going off at Nilin, and we needed to film it. So, with a Herculean effort, I dragged myself out of bed. The combination of breakfast and a 2-hour sleep meant I was no longer pissed, at least. But I already had the beginnings of the world's worst hangover, the kind that had not quite arrived, but like an advancing army, you could see it just on the horizon and hear the noise it made. I cursed my luck. I was supposed to wake up refreshed, that was the plan. Now I was going to have to suffer the full hangover in glorious technicolor. As I heaved myself into my clothes, I felt my stomach churn and lurch, a stew of undigested Guinness, pickled fish and eggs beginning to make its presence felt. If you've never been in this kind of state, then congratulations, and I really don't recommend trying it. But if you have, then you'll know what I'm talking about. When you suddenly become all too aware of what's sitting there inside you, and when you start worrying that whatever's inside you might want to find its way out again. We jumped in the jeep, and by the time we got to Nilin, I was fully accustomed to the sensation of rising bile in my mouth, and already sweating like a dyslexic on countdown. For a moment, though, I forgot my hangover, as we arrived to find a scene of open warfare. Good old professionalism kicked in. I dragged on my body armor and helmet, and we began filming. On a bank on the other side of a wall 10 or 11 feet high, protesters had been hurling huge rocks over the fence to where the gathered IDF troops scurried into position. In war, they say that whoever has the high ground has the advantage, and you'd have to say that the Arabs had the advantage here. But they didn't have the firepower. Sure enough, just as we got there, the Israeli commander was calling in a water cannon. And not just any old sort of water cannon. This beast fires a green solution they call skunk. A mix of sewage, chemicals, and animal manure. This stuff makes you sick if you come into contact with it, and it stinks. I mean, it reeks to high heaven. No wonder the protesters withdrew as thick fountains of the stuff were propelled over the wall. Where we were standing was in the face of the wind, and it was impossible to avoid the smell of it blowing back towards us. My stomach lurched. It's true that there's nothing like a bit of excitement to cure a hangover, or at least make you forget it. It's also true that there's nothing like a strong whiff of chemicals, sewage, and animal manure to make you remember it. By this time, the crew and I had taken cover behind a blast wall, the idea being that we could film the protest from a position of relative safety away from the flying rocks. Trouble was, as so often happens, the protesters clocked us, and rather than being the observers we hoped to be, we suddenly found ourselves the target. Having regrouped from the skunk attack, the guys on the other side of the wall changed direction, began scrambling along the bank towards our position behind the blast wall, and started slinging rocks directly at us. Now we were properly pinned down and unable to move from behind the blast wall. It was an 8-foot-high concrete wall with sight holes, but the Palestinians were using slings, the sort of thing David used against Goliath, and were so accurate with the rocks, they were actually finding their way through the holes. Not all the time, obviously, but in addition to the rocks sailing over our heads. We watched in dismay, as Israelis crouched behind a blast wall not far away, donned gas masks, and began launching tear gas. There was the familiar pop, 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 as they discharged their assault rifles, firing smoke grenades over the wall. But it was pointless, because gusts of wind were catching the tear gas and blowing it right back at us. The protesters saw their chance, and with the wind in their favour, were able to pick up the canisters of tear gas and start lobbing them back over the wall with the accuracy of Jockey Wilson. The grenades trailed smoke as they came looping over the wall and clanged down by our feet, rolling and hissing as they dispensed gas. Things were getting hairy now, the protesters proving as accurate with the tear gas grenades as they had been with the rocks. Every few seconds came the whizzing firework sound of tear gas cylinders arcing through the air. Peeking around the wall was an increasingly dangerous activity, especially as we were being deliberately targeted by the protesters. Pop, 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 whiz, clang. Tear gas canisters were landing just the other side of our blast wall, and by now smoke was everywhere, most of it on our side of the fence. At one point I peeked around the wall, quickly withdrew to safety, then looked to my right to see Tom Watson, resplendent in a gas mask. Not only that, the cheeky sod was giving me the thumbs up. Of course, Muggins here couldn't wear a gas mask, because I'm supposed to be doing pieces to camera. So every now and then the wind would deliver me a new gust of tear gas right in the face. Like I said, it affects any part of your body that's wet, which is why it's such agony if it gets in your eyes. If you're sweating, say, if you've been up all night drinking, ho-hum, it'll get you in any sweaty bits, too. The feeling is like a constant stinging. I tell you, I've had some bad hangovers in my time, but that one took the biscuit. My underarms were stinging, and my sweaty bollocks were stinging, but they were like a mild irritation compared to my eyes. They were like two little globes of agony, like I wanted to pluck them out of my skull and give them a good wash before popping them back in again. They stayed that way for the whole 4 hours, yes? 4 hours. We were pinned down behind the blast wall. God knows how I kept my breakfast down, but after a while I was glad of the sustenance, and once the sickness had subsided, it wasn't too bad. Apart from the dehydration, the sting of the tear gas, and the constant fear of being hit by flying rocks. The footage that eventually made it into the film is a compendium of about 4 hours of us being there. And then, thanking God it was all over, and feeling absolutely snapped, as they say in the army, we returned to the hotel. There, I drank litre after litre of water. God, I don't think I've ever been so dehydrated in my life. Next on the agenda was to, finally, sleep. But first, I needed a shower. I stripped off, climbed into the cubicle, and delivered a huge sigh of relief as the warm water gushed over me. A sigh of relief that turned into a scream of agony as the water reactivated the tear gas sticking to my previously dry skin. And suddenly it was as though I was being rubbed all over by a giant chili, my entire body in agony. As I crashed out of the shower, danced in pain around the room, then set about desperately scraping the tear gas powder off my skin. I was red raw by the end of it, when I collapsed into bed, and as I slipped into unconsciousness, I realized the entire thing had been witnessed by three old dears who'd been watching me through the window. The next day I told the rest of the guys about the chilly shower, and it was Tom who said to me, "You've been tear gassed before, Ross. Shouldn't you have known better?" "Yeah, it's all well and good when you have a gas mask, Tom. Anyway, this Israeli tear gas was some kind of superior grade tear gas. I'd never known any tear gas have that kind of effect before. Secondly, I'm never normally near a shower." E is for Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Tear Gas, Part 2. At a railway station 5 miles outside Krakow in Poland, a city that is otherwise one of the most beautiful I've ever visited, nervous cops waited for a few hundred football supporters to arrive by train. Not just any old football supporters, though. Arriving were fans of Lech Poznan, rivals of the local side Wisla Krakow. And nor was it just any old train. For a start, the journey was 5 hours long, and because of the way fans behave, the train company gives them the worst carriages. Toilets? Forget about it. There was a hole in the floor. And when it eventually pulled into the station, the fans, having endured this miserable 5-hour journey in Poland's worst and oldest rolling stock, were met first by nervous riot police and dogs, and then by rival Wisla fans baying for their blood. The cops, not just any old cops. Imagine the stormtroopers in Star Wars, except in black. That was these guys. Masked, heavily armed, many with rifles loaded with plastic bullets, and some with canisters of tear gas strapped to their backs, and as the train trundled into the station, it was as though an electric charge passed along their lines. They were ready for a fight, and in many ways were well up for it. These guys, not to mention the arriving Lech Poznan supporters and the Wisla fans who were waiting at the ground, were all anticipating the fight. I'm sure there were genuine fans who arrived inside that train, but looking at the guys who got off, 90% of whom were shaven-headed and some of whom were hiding their faces, either from the police cameras or from us, there weren't many of them. The fans were herded onto a bus, you'd say like cattle, only cattle are treated better, then escorted to the ground. Inside, it was like a crucible of hate. All that seemed to separate the two sets of fans were flimsy, corrugated iron fences. At one point, I thought they were going to come down through sheer manpower. It was like watching a medieval battle. Meanwhile, lines of riot police, still wired and up for a fight, roamed the top of the stands, ready to descend should trouble break out. What am I talking about? Should? There was no doubt, no doubt in anyone's mind, that trouble was going to break out here. Things had gone well at the train station. I'd been told that the fact the fans weren't chanting was a good sign, and the efforts to dampen their spirits with a dreadful train journey might have done the trick. But it was always going to be a false dawn because, let's face it, these guys hadn't come all the way from West Central Poland just to enjoy a great game of football and a bit of friendly banter with the Wisla fans. Oh no, these guys were here for a fight. Pissed up, hungry and freezing, but still up for a fight. And they were going to get it. About 5 minutes after the whistle was blown and the match started, something unusual caught my eye. One of the fans in the Wisla end, close to where I stood, was not presently involved with either chanting or yelling abuse at the visiting supporters. Instead, he stood talking seriously into his mobile phone, his eyes fixed on a point over my shoulder. I swung around and looked to the other side of the ground, following his gaze. There, standing on the Lech Poznan terraces, was a corresponding phone user. He, too, was speaking into his phone, eyes fixed on his Wisla counterpart. To me, it was obvious. These guys were talking to one another. They were both laughing. Were they the ringleaders, bantering with a few choice insults? Whore being a popular and particularly rude Polish insult. Or were they organising the afternoon's entertainment, doing the football hooligan equivalent of setting a date for later? Not so much ladies who lunch as lads who lump each other. Either way, whether the mobile phone conversation was part of it or not, it did indeed kick off. It was the fans right in front of me, the Wisla crew, who started it. Unable to reach the Lech Poznan visitors, they instead turned their attentions on the security and police. Rooted to my spot by the side of the pitch, I felt the force of the violence come blasting off the stands as fans raced across the terraces and towards security guards. With a roar, the marauding fans charged a line of clear riot shields, attacking them with a clatter of boots on perspex. In return, the guards began pushing back, wielding rubber truncheons and clobbering the fans, who scrambled back ready for a second massed attack. To try and prevent another charge, the security guards deployed tear gas. Like I said, they carry it in canisters on their back, the kind of thing gardeners employ to carry weed killer, except with a far greater range. This, I found out to my cost, when, thanks to a slight case of overgassing plus an unfortunate gust of wind, I caught a dose of it in the face. And wow, that was painful. Like being repeatedly slapped across the face. Imagine, in fact, somebody is repeatedly slapping you across the face and you, for some reason, cannot move your face away. It stings. By God, it stings. It makes you cough, and as I've already described, your eyes well up until it feels like they're going to swell up and boil right there in your skull. And of course it gets you in your throat, too. I mean, if you're standing there with your gob open, as I obviously was, it'll get in your throat. You can even feel it in your ears. To be honest, though, in the end it wasn't the tear gas I was most worried about. As the violence continued to rage, with the fans charging the security guards, the baton-wielding guards charging back, and the match having long since been suspended, what concerned me was that some of those rather lightweight-looking barriers might come down. Thankfully, they didn't. We emerged from the stadium unharmed, if a little shaken, and in my case with streaming eyes and stinging skin, wondering why on earth they call it the beautiful game. East Timor was where I got my next dose of tear gas. In 2002, when the Indonesians were told to leave East Timor thanks to a UN referendum, this tiny country lodged between Indonesia and Australia became the world's youngest democracy. However, it began an era of vicious infighting as rival factions within the country vied for power. It's in such conditions that gang culture flourishes. Sure enough, in East Timor, it's said that a fifth of the population are gang members of some sort. And that, of course, was why we had made it our destination for an episode in the second series of Gangs. While there, I witnessed strange initiation ceremonies, was introduced to some bizarre weapons, the like of which I had never seen before, and some jaw-dropping martial arts in action. It was also my next experience with tear gas. It really kicked off during our last day. We had just conducted what we thought would be our final interviews, including one with the President, José Ramos Horta, and were getting ready to leave, little knowing that a major political situation was just about to come to the boil. Shortly after we'd spoken to him, Ramos Horta had announced the name of his Prime Minister, and the gangs supporting the losing candidate were none too happy about his decision. Trouble kicked off in the Internally Displaced Persons IDP camp in the capital city, Dili, which was across from our hotel. I've seen some pretty horrible IDP camps in my time. The Eldoret Showground in Kenya, home to countless displaced persons, stretched literally as far as the eye could see. And what I knew was that they're breeding grounds for disease, for criminality, for gang activity. The perfect place to go if you need to whip up political support of a violent disposition. If you wanted to start a riot, in other words. The word came round that there was a disturbance at the IDP camp, so out we rushed. The thing was, I wasn't long back from Afghanistan at this point. I'd been used to .762 rounds and RPGs whizzing over my head, so I wasn't worried about a few rocks. I should have been, of course, and must have had rocks in my head not to have been, but I can only tell you how I felt at the time, which was up for anything. It wasn't uncommon for me to go piling into some situation, doing what I thought was a piece to camera, only to turn around and discover there was no cameraman with me. Some cameramen do wars, some don't, because some have seen too much. This was one of those times. I had to run back and collect the cameraman as we rushed out of the hotel and across to the IDP camp. There we found the street already thronged with people, mainly gangs streaming from the camps who were throwing rocks at UN peacekeeping forces. And when I say rocks, I mean like huge boulders. The kind of rock that would easily cave in your skull if your skull got in the way. We stuck close to the troops. Meanwhile, our fixer, Oricio, pulled me to one side. From a shop by the side of the road, he'd grabbed a tub of cream and was slapping it in my face. I reared back. Hey! Hey, what the hell are you doing? No, no, let me. It'll stop the tear gas, he explained. And he was absolutely right, because, as I've said, the tear gas works on contact with moisture. So what the cream does is set up a barrier between you and the chemicals that make tear gas sting your skin. Little tip for you there, if you ever find yourself in the firing line. The other thing about the gas is that a lot depends on how it's deployed, and whether you're using grenades or even those garden spray canisters the cops in Poland used, you stand a very good chance that a single brutal gust of wind will send the whole thing back in your direction. Just as it had in the stadium at Krakow and the demonstration at Nilin, the weather played a part in the dispersal of tear gas used by the peacekeepers on the streets of East Timor. And once again, yours truly found himself with a face full of it. But of all the occasions, I've got to say this one was probably the least painful. For that, I have to thank Oricio. Oricio and some lady's cold cream or moisturizer or whatever it was. Brilliant. Still, it got my throat. There was no escaping that. having taken shelter in a street that just hours before had been a normal street, but was now filled with makeshift weapons that had been dropped in a hurry, bricks, boulders and sticks, and was thick with smoke from burning tyres. I saw an old woman, who was clearly in pain from the tear gas. She spat to try and clear her throat, and seeing her do it, I did the same. Instantly she was glaring at me, then making her way across the street, a finger pointing as she jabbered something at me I couldn't possibly understand. From the side of my mouth I said, "What the hell is she saying, Orisio?" Orisio, ever the lifesaver, was calming her down and in between speaking to her told me, "She thinks you're taking the piss out of her by spitting. I told you weren't." But she was about to stab you anyway. If you've seen the film, you'll see I described the East Timorians as a warrior race. There, I had the solid proof. Towards the evening, things quietened down, and we retreated to a restaurant just outside Dili. Oh my God, these guys really know how to cater during a riot. The barbecue in this restaurant was at the table, and we sat around eating great giant flakes of beautiful white fish. The restaurant overlooked the bay of Dili, and for a while we were able to forget the violence still raging just minutes away. Just then, Orisio burst in. "Guys, guys, you better come right away. Your hotel is on fire." "Shut up," we told him. "Sit down, have a beer." "No, no, I'm being serious. The hotel is on fire, look." We piled to a balcony and looked across the bay towards the rest of the town. From the smoke billowing into the skyline, it was clear that far from calming down, things were only just heating up. Literally heating up. Sure enough, one of the fires did seem to be emanating from our hotel. Reluctantly, we left the gorgeous baked whitefish, some of us more reluctant than others, naming no names, and tore across town, only to find that our hotel wasn't on fire. Phew. Instead, it was the building next door, a records office. This is one thing I've learnt making the films, that when it all kicks off, records offices are usually the first places to be burnt. That's often because it's in the interests of those behind the riots to destabilize whatever system is in place. And how better to do that than by destroying official documents? In the case of the situation at East Timor, like a lot of tribal conflict, there are plenty of disputes over land, and so the land records go up. Not that the records office was the only place alight. The whole city seemed to be burning. With gas cans in homes and buildings popping off, it was an incredibly volatile situation. We reached the records office, which if anything burnt fiercer than many of the surrounding buildings. There we found an old guy throwing buckets of water on the blaze. "Excuse me, mate," I said to him, "could we use your ladder to get some shots?" "Yeah, I know." The guy looked at me, and his jaw dropped open in disbelief. "Piss off," he spat at me. "Just piss off." We moved on, and ended up getting the shots we wanted elsewhere, but I could see his point. What can I say? The excitement of the moment just gets the better of you sometimes. F is for the fine art of travelling through the Peruvian jungle, part one. If it ever seems as though I'm repeating myself during this book, then for that I apologise. But if it's worth saying once, it's worth saying 1,000 times, we don't judge. Wherever we encounter conflict, whether it's ideological or otherwise, we try to look at both sides of the story, let both camps have their say, and allow the viewers to make up their minds. Never do we stand in the middle saying this is wrong or this is right. For that reason, with the odd exception, we don't get involved in the lives of those we talk to. We're there to report upon, not influence, events. Even so, every now and then you have to stop, take a deep breath, and remind yourself you're there as an observer, not as a normal bloke. One such occasion was during the making of Battle for the Amazon, when we joined the police on a raid of an illegal gold mining town deep in the Peruvian rainforest called Lamal, roughly translated as the wrong. I was about to find out how wrong. We'd got the access to this raid, thanks to our fixer on the job, a brilliant and brave man who, for reasons detailed elsewhere, must remain nameless. I think what he'd done was tell the police that we were in Peru making a film about the destruction of the rainforest, and that they might, just might, want to show the Peruvian authorities taking some kind of positive action to stop this destruction taking place. Whether they had planned the raid without us, or it was entirely for our benefit, I couldn't say. Fact was that after weeks of at times tense negotiations, and don't forget there's always the risk that the authorities might simply decide they don't want to be bossed around by a group of gringos from England, come after us and nick all our equipment, we reached an agreement. We could join the cops and a prosecutor from the Madre de Dios area on a raid of La Mal, the aim being to rescue underage prostitutes who worked there servicing the miners. Getting there, though, was a story in itself. The arrangement was that we'd meet the police at a secure point around 10 miles from La Mal. We drove for a day or so to get there, reached the meeting point in plenty of time, and waited. But the time came and went, and 4 to 5 hours later, we were still sitting by the side of the road getting more and more agitated. It's funny, because I can distinctly remember wishing I was able to enjoy this moment properly, thinking of when I worked on EastEnders, when, even though I loved being part of the show, I hated travelling, rushing around London for anything up to 3 hours each day, trying to make my way to the studios. And I can remember sitting on the edge of the jungle in Peru, wishing I could savour the total peace and tranquility as the sun began to go down. And yet, I was unable to because of the worry that we might have been stood up by the police, and the fear that we'd wasted a day driving to reach this point. It stopped me being able to enjoy the glorious surroundings. What if the police had simply decided that they didn't want to be bossed around by a bunch of gringos from England? We left them waiting for us on the edge of the jungle for 42 days. Ha ha, big joke. Me and the crew have this thing, the knuckle thing, which in gangsters do it, knock knuckles. But, like a lot of piss-takey things you start, it had sort of ended up becoming real. Something we did if we'd had a particularly successful day. Good day today? Knuckles. That day, though, as the hours wore on and there was still no sign of the police, nobody was doing knuckles anymore. Instead, frantic phone calls were being made. The poor old fixer was in a bit of a panic. And then suddenly, as if from nowhere, came the roar of engines, and from behind us, trucks thundered along the road towards us, dimmed headlights sweeping across our position, and we knew it was on. Scrambling to our feet, we watched as the trucks ground to a halt, and highly armed Peruvian cops streamed off them, running to the tailgates and dropping them. In the next moment, there was another roar as more cops on motorbikes came tearing off the back of the trucks. Assembled was a team, around 50 to 60 strong, some in uniform with bulletproof vests, others in plain clothes. Apart from the prosecutor, there were some doctors and medical staff, whose function on the raid would soon become apparent. There was no way of taking the trucks into the jungle. Either by accident or by design, La Mal was accessible only by dirt track, so the way of reaching it was by trail bike. We thought the police would take us on the back of their bikes, but there wasn't enough room. The idea was that a forward party, the heavily armed guys, would race on ahead to secure the brothels and hopefully stop any outbreaks of trouble, while the rest of us would follow on. Follow? But on what? Our quick-thinking fixer saved the day yet again by legging it down the road and hastily hiring 450cc taxi bikes. And then we set off. As we began the journey, it was starting to get dark, and the cone of light from our motorbikes was hardly enough to illuminate the way. We came to a small, tented community selling water, biscuits, and nuts. We were still in convoy by this point, trying to stay together. But then we continued. Next stop, La Mal. And as the already narrow path became even narrower, the convoy began to break up. The sky was burning ruby, blood-orange red through the gaps in the forest canopy, getting really dark now. We were literally seeing stars appear before our very eyes. We hit a rope bridge, with a significant drop either side at 50 mph. I gripped the pillion rails hard and clenched my teeth. Fucking hell! But if I was bricking it, then spare a thought for the cameraman, Will Churchill, on this occasion. He was doing what I was doing, except he was looking into a camera at the same time. Kif McManus, our sound guy, was holding on with one hand and holding the boom with the other. On we went, over more and more bridges, upwards of 20 of them, I'd say. A journey that took us the best part of an hour, and fair play to our drivers, these guys were skilled beyond belief. I couldn't have done what they were doing in broad daylight, let alone at night, with a large chap sitting on the back shouting in my ear. What's more, this was the one route in and out of Lamel. So as well as the motorcycles overtaking us, there were bikes coming in the opposite direction, too. Just like in the Congo, these bridge users weren't bothering to stop, give way, or give a friendly nod and wave like a couple of Fiat-driving old ladies at a box junction. No, these guys came full pelt and sod you if you were in the way. Loads of times you'd find yourself brushing elbows with guys riding bikes in the opposite direction, knowing the slightest jolt might be enough to send you off balance and plummeting off the side of a rope bridge. And then, all of a sudden, the forest stopped. There was a clearing, another rope bridge, and then the town, Lamel. I'd taken a helicopter over mining areas in the weeks prior to the raid, and from what I'd seen, these temporary settlements were fairly small affairs. But this was huge. Lamel was on a scale I hadn't dared to imagine, like a large town, a city. It appeared to be a cross between Blade Runner and a shanty town, a neon-lit, higgledy-piggledy ramshackle place, a bit like a music festival after dark, with makeshift lights strung from the canopies of cobbled-together buildings. Among stalls selling fake designer watches, belts, T-shirts, you name it, were bars, many of them garishly lit video bars. These were the brothels. Though we were officially in the middle of a raid, the town wasn't in the state of uproar I'd imagined it would be, the advance party having quelled any possible disturbance. Cops with assault rifles had entered the brothels and were already beginning the process of inspecting the girls living there. Following the prosecutor, we entered the first of the brothels, only to be greeted by a foul stench of stale beer and mildew. The inside of these shacks were painted lurid, sleazy colours of luminous green and pink, and at the back was where the girls were kept. They cowered beneath plastic or tarpaulin, their knees drawn up to their chests, shivering and frightened. I stopped and had to resist putting my hand to my mouth, hardly able to believe they could be living in such terrible conditions. The smell of the rain, the plastic sheeting that most of the buildings were constructed out of, the mildew and the stench of stale beer stay with me to this day. There were the usual cuddly toys, see S is for soft toys, and there were babies too, being looked after by these terribly young mothers, none of whom looked 18. Yet of course, every single one of them claimed they were of legal age. This is where the health authority came in, where in surgical gloves, nurses inspected the teeth of the girls to make a ruling on their age. Most, it seemed, were around 14 or 15, which figured. None of the girls were dressed particularly provocatively. Instead, they wore shorts and vest tops. Not only were they underage, but they wanted to look it. Why? The minors prefer sex with underage girls because they believe there's less risk of sexually transmitted diseases. The police, of course, were here to rescue them, but that in itself presented a dilemma. A lot of these girls, rescued or not, would never be able to return to a normal life. These were girls who'd been lured to Lamel with the promise of a job in a restaurant or a bar. Well, they'd got a job in a bar, all right. Just not what they expected. Having rescued them, the idea was to reunite them with their families, but many would be shunned or disowned, having been seen to have brought disgrace upon themselves or the family name. To this day, I have no idea how many of them were there. As I said, this was a big town, There was bar after bar, brothel after brothel, and the police and health authorities were thorough, searching through each one. One thing I was surprised about was the lack of resistance. There seemed no attempt at flight, nor were the cops given any backchat by the girls. Yes, the cops were armed, but even so, the girls seemed to accept this latest twist of fate meekly, accustomed to dealing with whatever life threw at them, I suppose. We left the brothels, thankful to be back out in the night air, away from the oppressive heat and stink and that revolting luminous paint. And I found myself standing nearby where some mine workers were having a drink. One thing I'd learnt about the miners was that they have an odd belief. They believe that the more badly you behave, the more luck you accumulate. As a result, many were very abusive towards the girls, physically and sexually abusive. And I became aware that three mine workers were looking at me, laughing. "Fuck you, fuck you, fuck you," they were saying, just laughing at me, if it wasn't for all these police around kind of thing, like it was all a big joke to them. I wondered if these were the same guys who thought being bad brought you good luck. I could feel myself rising to their bait as I started to make my way over to them. Apparently my non-judgmental self had decided to stay at home that night. Tom stopped me. "Come on, mate, let's go." And I came to my senses in the nick of time. I did the right thing, the not-getting-involved thing. I walked away to the sound of their jeers at my back. Turning round and looking over my shoulder, giving them my best Grant Mitchell, I walked slap-bang into a washing line of dripping wet knickers. Wet with what, to this day, I cannot say. Laughs all round from the miners. But better laughs than what might have happened if I hadn't walked away. F is for the fine art of travelling through the Peruvian jungle, part two. Prior to making these films, I'd never been what you'd call an eco-warrior. I love my car and the benefits that oil bring me. But at the same time, I've seen close up what our greed for this stuff is doing to the planet. In Nigeria, an oil-rich country where one in five children dies before their fifth birthday, they burn the excess gases used in the extraction of crude oil, sending plumes of thick black smoke up to the atmosphere. Some of these burn-offs are 10 buses high, 6 buses wide, an incredible waste of energy, and a constant source of light that affects the lives of people and animals for miles around. Seeing that burn-off at night for the first time was an eye-opener for me, and a major factor in what changed my mind about the environment. Then, still in Nigeria, making In Search of Pirates this was, there were the disused wellheads left by the oil companies and supposedly cleaned up, from which miscreants could help themselves to gallons and gallons of oil. Let me tell you, these guys are even less concerned about the welfare of the planet than the oil companies, and the mess they leave behind is unbelievable, a mess that often finds its way into the water table. Another of those mind-changing moments took place in Peru, while making the two films that became Battle for the Amazon. In the first film, we'd visited Ecuador. See, N is for never walk around the back of a helicopter, and T is for a totemic tropical takeoff, where we discovered how the greed for oil has caused untold damage to humans, wildlife, and forest. Moving on to Brazil, we saw how beef production and soya plantations have destroyed acres of irreplaceable forest. And then, in the second film, we travelled to Peru. Just as in Ecuador and Brazil, the wildlife and inhabitants of Peru suffer thanks to the production of commodities we crave in the West. It's oil in Ecuador, beef and soya in Brazil, but in Peru, it's cocaine and gold. Fully one-third of the world's cocaine comes from Peru. In the foothills of the Andes is the Vrai Valley, which, according to the United Nations, has more coca plants in it per hectare than anywhere else on the planet. There, makeshift cocaine labs are used to transform the naturally growing leaf into the base for cocaine. Every year, around 750 tons of the stuff finds its way out of the Amazon basin and up the noses of pleasure-seeking Westerners, who fork out an estimated $85 billion on it. And yet, despite the eye-watering amounts of money we're talking about, the Virai Valley is one of the poorest regions in the whole of Peru. Illiteracy, malnutrition, unemployment, you name it, they have it. Not only that, but its habitat is being destroyed by its plentiful crop. It's estimated that 1,000 acres of forest are lost to cocaine production every day. And yet, coca growing in Peru has been going on since the time of the Incas. And though a whopping 99% of it goes into the illegal narcotics trade, it's still legal to grow a small amount for chewing or brewing in tea. You can see it on the market, right next to the papaya, bananas and limes. Imagine for a moment that you're an ordinary Joe living in the Virai Valley. The coca leaf grows naturally there. It's been cultivated for thousands of years. It's available at your local market, and the chances are you know someone who makes a living, legally or illegally, from the coca leaf. In other words, one way or another, you will almost certainly benefit from the coca leaf. But on the other hand, the place is crawling with bandana-wearing paramilitaries whose job it is to stamp out the whole trade. They're trying to destroy your livelihood. It's fair to say that relations between ordinary civilians and the gun-wielding paramilitaries were frosty at best. Into this mix, add two white Toyota vans full of gringos heading for the Virai Valley. Our plan was contact with coca growers there, see for ourselves what sort of conditions they worked in, and the damage the trade was doing to the environment. First, though, we had to reach our base, a town in the foothills of the Andes called San Francisco. Same name as the one in California, but there the similarity ends. Neither should you be fooled by the word foothills, like we were right down at the bottom. Oh no, this is the Andes we're talking about. The foothills are in the clouds. Having arrived by plane, we began a 10 or 11 hour journey at a fairly high altitude, then clambered into the vans to begin a 7 hour journey to San Francisco. And believe you me, we were climbing every step of the way. It was December, rainy season, and the roads, which are narrow and badly maintained at the best of times, were partially flooded. Fast-flowing water streamed past us from the hills above, making the highways even more treacherous. But we climbed, and we climbed. Going was slow, and made slower by the fact that every now and then we'd have to stop and clamber out to manoeuvre the vans out of the mud. Then there were the bridges. A speciality in that part of Peru is the very rickety wooden bridge, a few planks of railway sleeper haphazardly laid between two banks. Luckily, our driver was a Jedi when it came to negotiating them, while the rest of us became experts at staring out the windows and shouting, "Fucking hell!" He got us across, though, every time. You can keep your four-wheel drive. You'd see 100 times more four-wheel drive vehicles in Mayfair than you would in the foothills of the Andes. It's the skill of the drivers that keeps the motors running. They know the roads. They know the terrain. They know the people. To us gringos, the sheeting rain looked like a daily dose of death, and we approached each new obstacle thinking, "What fresh hell is this?" But to the locals, it was just the time of year. No big deal. Nothing we can't handle. And don't forget, we were gringos. On the roads, a kind of community spirit reigned, and at times we were given help to push the van out of a tight spot. On other occasions, however, faces turned away from us. People spat. And one time, as we crossed yet another bridge, a teenage lad who was sitting by the side of the road raised his hand at me, his fingers in the shape of a gun. A kid having a bit of a laugh at my expense? Maybe. But somehow I didn't think so. I think he was saying, "You're not welcome here." Still, we climbed. We negotiated the dragon's dens, areas where locals would place stones in the road and passers-by would have to pay a small toll to pass. Still, the rain came down. We were white-knuckling it now. We watched water seep in the door sills, and prayed the engine would stay dry, or at least dry enough to keep turning over. Torrents of rain fell. Every now and then we'd see a car literally float past us, swept away by the flood. Passing us going downhill was a constant procession of locals, in cars, on motorcycles, on foot. We'd see buses, rammed with passengers, not to mention livestock, squawking chickens and squealing pigs, like something out of Romancing the Stone. Next, we came to an especially steep section where a lorry was having trouble crossing a makeshift bridge, and having previously benefited from help out of a sticky spot, we jumped out of our own vehicle to lend a hand. Around us was a tailback perhaps a mile and a half in both directions, as we worked to try and strengthen the weather-beaten bridge, enough for the lorry to cross. Water was rushing down from the hillside, a deluge of it that battered the lorry as we worked to thrust rocks beneath the wheels, anything to give the tyres a bit of traction as the vehicle progressed in tiny increments across the bridge, with nothing either side apart from cloud and the rush of water. There was not an inch, not a centimetre to spare. One slip, a simple weight shift, and the lorry would have plummeted from the side of the bridge and down the hill into... what? We couldn't see, because by now we were above the cloud. Way, way above the cloud. So when you looked down, what you saw was the lush green carpet of the treetops, then the misty, dreamlike billows of the cloud cover. From our vantage point, it was impossible to gauge how high we were. We might as well have been floating in space. When we breathed, the air was thin, as though we were breathing in cloud vapour. Everything about our location added to a sense of otherworldliness. At last we reached a summit of sorts, then began to descend the other side. This time we were moving with the flow of water flooding from the highlands, making the going slightly easier. We stopped to eat potatoes. Not the sort of potato we used to from the supermarkets at home, but some kind of weird, discovered by Sir Walter Raleigh potatoes that to this day I can't decide were the best or worst potatoes I've ever tasted. Not that we had time to savour them. It was only the briefest of pit stops to refuel, because night was beginning to fall, and we were increasingly aware that we were tempting prey for the bandits we'd been told roamed the road. Bandits who would place rocks across the road and make you pay to pass. Feeling our bodies change as the air pressure dropped, we came down into the Vrai Valley. If we needed any proof that we were entering Peru's biggest drug-producing area, where about a third of the country's coca is cultivated, then here it was. A traffic jam, with hard-faced government troops stopping and searching vehicles, and jeeps by the side of the road, with troops on rooftops manning mounted machine guns. They were looking for drugs, or for paraffin, which is used to process the coca leaf. Eyed suspiciously by the troops, we got through the checkpoint, and then we were in the Vrai Valley. After that, we drove for 6 or 7 hours to get to our final destination. Then, finally, we arrived. We were in San Francisco. Built on the banks of a fast-flowing, surging river, San Francisco is about the size of a provincial town in the UK. One thing was for sure, though, we stuck out like a sore thumb. Here we were, well, perhaps the enemy, might be putting it a bit too strongly, but certainly we were viewed with suspicion. To the locals, white guys like us represented law enforcement, or DEA. Like I say, the inhabitants of that part of the world have an ambivalent relationship with the coca leaf. The army guys, at least their intentions were obvious. But us? What were we doing there? What did we want in the Vrai Valley? We'd been viewed with suspicion by the troops at the entrance to the valley, and we'd go on to be viewed with suspicion by the residents of San Francisco. There's a lot of paranoia in that part of the world. Not surprising, really. We really were out on a limb here. For the whole time we'd driven, we'd hardly stopped, pausing only to eat and give the drivers a quick rest and a piss. For most of us, it wasn't a problem. All we had to do was stare out the windows and gawk at the incredible scenery and grab a kip every now and then. And since this was in my loud snoring days, I suppose I deserved it that they recorded me. For the drivers, however, it was a problem, and by now they were really flagging. Absolutely.